listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 155 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Conference. My name is Kevin.
Podcast.
What did I say? Oh my gosh.
You've got conference on the brain.
Oh my gosh. Episode number 155 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, because that's what this is. And this is going to be a conference recap show. I almost said podcast recap show. Chris, you got me all messed up. Joining me is Chris. I think I said my name is Kevin. And if you haven't guessed, we're in conference recovery mode right now.
and if it was the 155th conference, we'd all be very old right now.
Unless we started taking it on tour and doing more than one a year.
That's true. Regional conferences.
There we go. And after that love fest, how could you not want to do that?
It is kind of addicting. And I was talking to Brad, another one of our coworkers here today, and he kind of doesn't know what to do with himself in the office now.
I know yesterday I was back at work and I just kind of sat here going, what do I do with myself now? I've been planning this event for 9 months and was ultra stressed out for the last 3 months and beyond stressed the last couple weeks leading up to it. And now that it's all gone, what do I do? How do I find meaning in my life anymore, Chris?
Well, there's the commercial holidays. There's Halloween. There's Christmas. There's...
So buy myself a bunch of stuff and eat lots of bad stuff.
Yeah. Good candy plan. And new guitar pedals.
Okay. I'll take your advice. So, yes, we are fresh off the first ever CD Baby DIY Musician Conference that happened in Chicago this past weekend. It was amazing. We will be talking about it in our as some big takeaways later on in the show. But, Chris, I want to mention that while the conference was happening, there was actually another pretty big news item that happened for CD Baby, but sort of got overshadowed by the conference. I say sort of because the people that weren't at the conference probably saw this or might have seen it. But
you're talking about my gig in Chicago, right?
Yes, exactly. No, I'm talking about... we had a CD Baby artist story that we pitched to the New York Times get picked up, and it was an artist by the name of Perrin Lamb. And if you didn't see that article, I encourage you to go check it out. It came out in the Friday print edition of the New York Times, but I think it went online Thursday evening. But it was Perrin is an artist that has seen some real success from Spotify and has made over $80,000 from Spotify. And so it was just trying to tell a different story than what a lot of the headlines you've been seeing about, I'm a major label artist and I made $50 from Spotify. And there being a lot of information that's missing, key information like writer splits, what the record label contract entails, and all those kind of things that really affect the outcome of the numbers, where this was a pretty true, transparent story. So that ran, and that was really cool. And hoping to maybe catch up with Perrin and have him on the podcast at a future episode.
I did a quick interview with him that I will post on the blog sometime soon, where he basically, you know, he didn't want to get into sort of comparing royalties between major label artists and whatever, you know, all the details that you're talking about. But what he did say is that he feels like he's been doing well there because he has his hands in all of the different areas. He's the 100% owner of the recording, 100% owner of his publishing. You know, there aren't all these other people coming in and taking a cut. So I thought that was an interesting point.
Agreed. And we've had so many conversations on the podcast where we're talking about these things. And of course, I always want artists to get paid better. I always want songwriters to get paid better. But what frustrates me more than anything is misinformation, because that just is, as much as people like to throw that around to sensationalize arguments, it usually in the end does more damage than good. And that's why when talking about Spotify and Pandora, in the past, I've people might think, oh, he's all for what, you know, what's Pandora currently pays, or doesn't want to get more money for songwriters. I do. I just want people to be using the right information, because sensational arguments just cause things to not get done. I want everyone to come to the table with the real story, with the real information, and make wise decisions that will get us to a better place in the future. And so this story was about as transparent as it can get. And I think that's what was interesting about it. And there wasn't this sensationalized article about, you know, somebody who's had millions and millions of plays somewhere and got $50. And it's like, well, you didn't disclose that you signed all away those rights to your label, and they're keeping that money. Someone's getting that money. It's just not right. You. So
it's going somewhere. And it's yet another story that kind of supports our, I feel like it's become our mantra in a way, the whole thing about don't neglect or abandon your old catalog, because in Perrin's case, you know, the songs that he's really making money from, they weren't super old, but you know, they were a year and a half old at the time they really started taking off. So
yeah, we need to do an episode that focuses in on some of the strategies that play into why he's seen success and all that. So that was in the New York Times last week. Right now it is October 28th. So Friday was the 23rd. And so if you want to check that out, it's a short read, but it's got some good stuff. And there was some other music business blogs that picked up some other pieces on it. I think Music Business Worldwide, which is a great blog you should read, I think they're carrying something about it, an op-ed piece that has more of the story that is going to be going live tomorrow, I believe. So you could be looking for that as well. So we've got lots to talk about with the conference, Chris, and so much greatness happened there, and it was so awesome. But first, we've got to get to some news.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
Music.
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 News.
Apple chief executive Tim Cook says that 6.5 million people are now paying for Apple Music after reaching the end of the streaming service's three-month free trial, while more than 8.5 million are still in the free period. It's the first official figures on the early conversion rate for the service, which launched on June 30th and saw its earliest adopters decide whether to start paying or cancel their membership on September 30th. I'm finding personally that I'm discovering a whole lot of music that I wasn't listening to before, Cook told a technology conference in California this morning. I think it's fabulous, and to have over 15 million on there and 6.5 million in the paid category, I'm really happy about it. And I think the runway here is really good. The news follows colleagues Eddie Cuse's announcement in early August that 11 million people had signed up for the free trial in its first month. 6.5 million subscribers makes Apple Music a comfortable second in the standalone music subscription market, still some way behind Spotify's 20 million paying customers, but ahead of Pandora's 3.9 million subscribers and Deezer's 3.8 million revenue-generating subscribers. Well, Adele released a new song titled Hello. The Adele video released on Friday surpassed 23.2 million views within the first 24 hours on YouTube. That edges out Taylor Swift's Bad Blood, which reached 20.1 million within its first 24. That was this past Friday, and as of recording this podcast, she has 112 million views. Today, YouTube officially launches YouTube Red, a premium subscription service available in the U.S. for $9.99 per month. YouTube's previous music streaming offering, YouTube Music Key, which was in beta, will be folded into this service under the name YouTube Music, a new dedicated YouTube music app that is designed to make discovering, watching, and listening to music on YouTube easier than ever. From the YouTube press release, YouTube said, YouTube Red lets you enjoy videos across all of YouTube without ads, while also letting you save videos to watch offline on your phone or tablet and play videos in the background, all for $9.99 a month. Your membership extends across devices and anywhere you sign into YouTube, including our recently launched gaming app and a brand new YouTube Music app we're announcing today that will be available soon. YouTube Music is designed to make discovering, watching, and listening to music easier than ever. Any song or artist you choose on YouTube Music will start you on a personal journey through one of the richest music catalogs. Just sign in, tap a track you love, and see where your music takes you. And as a special bonus, YouTube Red works with Google Play Music, so subscribe to one and automatically get access to the other. And starting early next year, YouTube Red will get even better with member-only access to new original shows and movies from some of YouTube's biggest creators. You can read all about originals coming to YouTube Red at youtube.com/red. And that's where you go to sign up for that as well. So YouTube finally launching the service they've been claiming they were going to launch for a long time. And of course, it's under a different name.
Yeah, so YouTube Music Key has been folded into this thing under the name YouTube Music, which is part of YouTube Red, for anyone that was really waiting around for Music Key to take off. That's what's happening. So I thought it was funny. On Wednesday, I went and looked at their the promo video for YouTube Red, and it had 1,000 likes and 1,500 dislikes. So, which may have had more to do with the song that was chosen for the video or something, you know, people might have just hated the video, but
it was a goofy video. I mean, it's getting to the point where, you know, I like a good video, but some of these tech companies, the videos that they try to like, we're for all people, bringing the world together, making the world a better place. Like Silicon Valley, it's almost like if you've seen that show on HBO, it's so hilarious. It feels watching that show feels like watching Portlandia does to me living in the Portland area. It's like, yeah, it's really becoming more of a just a kind of a commentary. It feels so much like it's not that far from the truth.
Yeah, I know. It's just like all aspirational fluff in a way. All these videos.
Like technology just makes your life a dream come true. And it's just like, it's just these videos, it's just funny. But anyway, so to me it sounds like they're going the route of probably Netflix eventually. I know they've been tapping into a lot of their creator community in order to do this original content, like some of the big YouTube stars trying to get people like, you know, probably PewDiePie, Miranda Sings, all these big YouTube channels, people like that, to get them to subscribe and back some of those channels to make original content that then lives in the subscription-only area, which it kind of could be an interesting experiment for YouTube, because a lot of the charm and why those people are so big, because it's not commercially produced content that's, has somebody a bean counter going, wait, is this going to get the right demographic? Are we going to get the views we want? It's just... So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that original content that they create.
Yeah, for anyone who has thought that it's a hard sell to go from free streaming, you know, ad-supported streaming, to a subscription service or a subscription model, I feel like it's even harder with video. Like, the idea of subscribing to YouTube is so alien to me. But we'll see how it works.
The one thing that I think could be interesting is I have a feeling that YouTube's recommendation engine could be better than all of the other services. Just for so many years of recommending videos.
Yeah.
I personally find that the recommendation engine works quite well, and it gets me far deeper into videos than I ever would before. And things that I just would never find. And I can get sucked in a YouTube, recommendation hole that just lasts me all night long. So I'm curious to see how their engine works. I think that's, you know, one of the things I've enjoyed about Apple Music is that they are, I've enjoyed some of the curated lists and some of the recommendations it gives me, and that have put some new artists in front of me that I never would have found otherwise. So I'm curious to see how that goes. But it's officially here. Also, I should say to artists, if you find your music on YouTube as an art track, is what they call it, which are album art. And it's just the song that plays, and you're using CD Baby for distribution, or even if you have another distributor, chances are it came from us. So don't freak out. Repeat, don't freak out. I'll repeat one more time. Don't freak out for the people that will freak out anyway. That music is, it works just like a streaming service. So if you opted in to have us send your music to streaming services, that's why they have it. You are getting paid in a similar fashion to how streaming services work. So don't worry. That's just how it's going with them. You can always have us, take it down if you don't want it there. But just that's where it came out. It's not a conspiracy to put your music places you don't want it. I think Apple Music, 6.5 paid subscribers. That's not bad.
Probably not what they hoped, but I feel like it's pretty good.
I feel like it's pretty good as well. It seems like there's still a lot of people in the free cycle. They probably picked up a lot of people in the free cycle with the launch of iPhone 6S.
And all the haters out there are just going to take it as a chance to, crap on them and say that it's a failure. But I disagree. I mean, I think it can be difficult to search through the catalog using it on your phone. But I still have faith. They'll work it all out within 6 months to a year.
I do have to say, and this will prove to anyone who thinks we're, at least that I'm an Apple fanboy, I don't know what they're doing over there with their podcast app. I have a feeling that whoever's doing whatever with it has never listened to a podcast before.
Particularly because it crashes every other week.
That, and with this latest update, they tried to make it just like Apple Music. And you don't engage with podcasts the same with like a music catalog. It is so difficult to use. It's always putting your podcast back in the cloud. It's so frustrating. I just want to see a desktop, like the icons, and have them tell me when there's new episodes and manage them independently. It's kind of like trying to manage them like a playlist altogether, and it's really frustrating. And then out of the blue, my wife started listening to podcasts, and it was syncing in between all our devices, so she kept deleting all my podcasts. I keep putting them back and deleting hers, and I'm like, yesterday I was about to get on a plane, and I'm like, please stop deleting my podcasts. They're all gone. What will I do on a plane without podcasts? So anyway, it feels like this was not designed for podcasts. So I got some suggestions from people for some other options. I know there's, I forget what the name of like a radio type one was, but I hated it, the interface, and it was full of ads, and I don't want to look at ads. I just want a clean, beautiful interface where I can listen to my podcast. So if you have any recommendations, feel free to email us or, at info@podcast.cdbabypodcast.com. And I will gladly try out some new options. But Apple Music seems like it's going well. And then, Adele, man, 120 million views. That was just this past Friday that launched, and it's Wednesday now. So she's going to be on her way to a billion views pretty darn quick.
Yeah, I saw an article that was interested me, had an interesting title that hooked me, and it was wondering if Adele's new album is going to be the last great album of the album age. Did you see that article?
I saw that,
and it kind of positioned her as this artist that appeals to all demographics and stuff, but particularly to people who are not totally locked into the streaming world yet. So that I thought that was kind of interesting. But what really interested me about this new video is that it had Michael from The Wire in it. I don't know if you watched The Wire, but
I have not. But what I heard you and Rob, our director of publishing, talking over the weekend, and that it was an amazing show. So I'll have to binge watch it at some point.
Yeah, you should.
So it'll be interesting to see how that does and the launch of her new album, how that lands in this really new economy of streaming, and if any new observations are gained from something that big being launched. So post Apple Music launch. So we'll see.
Adele will be fine either way.
I was really worried for her. Yeah. I thought, All right. Now we are going to do our official CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast Conference Recap. This is the official recap. None of the unofficial ones you might find out on the web. But Chris, did you love it? Did you hate it? Were you bored? Were you happy? Were you sad?
I was only sad when it was over. I was never bored. Actually, when we were stuffing those 1,200 tote bags, I might have gotten a little bored. But then the rock, paper, scissors team, that's some of the folks that helped us plan it, they started putting on Disney songs. So then that regained my attention. That was the only time I was bored. I loved it. I was excited and thrilled. I feel like it went so well, and it was so great to just meet so many different kinds of artists from all over the world. And I feel like they I don't know, it felt like everyone sort of already knew each other in a weird way.
Yeah, it was such a positive, excited, friendly atmosphere. And it was interesting because, you know, for CD Baby, I go to a lot of conferences, and some that are geared more towards artists, some that are not. And it was very clear from the moment people started showing up that this felt very different. It felt like, it wasn't in LA or New York. It was just in Chicago. Everyone was there together. A lot of people from out of town, more than we expected when we originally started planning the thing. And people were just excited to be together. People of different genres and ethnicities and backgrounds were just inviting each other to lunch together. I heard someone talking about how, I think it was an older individual that, you know, is like a singer-songwriter, went out to lunch, just randomly asked some hip-hop artist to go out to lunch with them, and they were commenting that they didn't think they would have anything in common, but over lunch they discovered they had so much in common. It was just so many great stories like that. I was like, that's what these things are for. It's not to come and feel like, who do I need to meet in order to make it? Which somebody actually commented to me that they said, I've been to other conferences where it just feels like everyone's walking around just like, who do I need to meet so I can make it? Where this felt like everyone wanted to learn from each other and be together, a very community atmosphere.
Yeah, I think there's also someone on Twitter, I think it was Chandler Coyle, said like, it wasn't the type of event where everyone's looking over your shoulder to see who else is more important in the room. Like, there was just a lot of focus on one another, and everyone from the artists and the speakers and the mentors kind of all were on the same level in a way and just hanging out together, which was awesome.
Yeah, it was great. And it was pretty interesting because, you know, we were in the middle of setting up and we had early registration on Friday, and I had no idea how many people would show up on Friday afternoon to you know, kind of go to the early registration. And you had a panel offsite that was sort of like a pre-conference thing, and I guess that had ended, and everyone back at the conference had we had sent them all the lunch, and I was standing at the CD Baby booth by myself just kind of finishing things up, and this wave of artists just kind of washed over me. And it was like suddenly the room was full and nobody was there but me, and I'm like, hi.
I bet they were all the people leaving once my panel was over.
I think they were. But it was so good. Some great takeaways. You know, we had, if you haven't heard us talk about the conference much, we really wanted to focus it on helping independent artists move their career forward. We did something that's probably unheard of for most conferences. I've never had this happen to me, and I've spoken at a lot of them. We vetted all the speakers. We made them give their presentation to us, at least walk through it to us, with us, and gave them feedback about, no, that you need to add some more actionable advice in this presentation. So we really wanted to make sure that the content was solid and that the artists got their money's worth, and that it was, you know, something that, you know, they'd walk away with some good nuggets no matter what they were interested in learning about. And then the Tom Jackson live band makeover was amazing. And we capped everything off with a high energy presentation by Martin Adkins. And so it was just a great weekend. So much goodness. So we've got some key takeaways from it.
Yeah, well, before we get to the takeaways, another highlight for me and probably for you was watching Black Milk perform at the showcase. I don't know if this...
Mind blowing. That's actually one of my takeaways I'll talk about in a minute. But
we don't have to get there yet. I was just going to say, Brad and I kept looking at each other and just being like, why are we even playing music?
Exactly. Exactly. And definitely want to give a shout out to all the podcast listeners that came up to us and said hi. That was so awesome to meet a lot of you in person. We even did, Chris and I did a live podcast recording that, you know, we will get those tapes and that episode will post soon. All the data and stuff we recorded, our video guy, Tony, has, and he's not back yet. He will be back in the office tomorrow. So I hope to have that episode up next week. We did a fun live taping of the podcast, and some of the listeners were there. And so it was awesome to meet people that have been listening and supporting the podcast for years. So, Chris,
indeed,
what are some? Let's start with a key takeaway. What were some of the key takeaways you have?
Okay, so this one probably on a high level sounds vague, but be prepared to seize your moment. And the example I will give is this guy named Sean Ardoin, who was the very first artist I met the whole weekend. You know, we had been there for a few days preparing and getting everything ready. And then I had that panel on Friday morning, which was sort of the pre-conference kickoff thing. It was off-site. I didn't know, you know, who would be there, how many people would be there. Anyways, Sean is one of the first guys that walks in and introduces himself, and we talk, and he's a really nice guy, and I was intrigued with his music, even though I didn't quite understand what it was going to sound like. He said it was like alternative Zydeco. He was trying to give me a mental picture for what it was. But anyways, so later on that night, we had our open mic. And he was not scheduled to play, but we had a lottery for four or five sort of extra slots that were still available. He signed up for the lottery. He got chosen. He had his accordion with him and some tracks that he had, you know, he didn't travel to the conference with his band. So he had his tracks on a CD, popped that in, and then rocked the house. Like, as soon as he went on, the entire room went up to the front of the stage and started dancing. And he was like amazing as an instrumentalist, good singer. And then his material and his stage presence were incredible. And then for the rest of the conference, he had this kind of not like a rock star status, like in terms of like some elevated position, but everyone knew him and everyone wanted to talk to him, tell him how amazing he was, help him out. Like, plus it also helped that all 3 days he wore a shirt with his Twitter handle on it. But, yeah.
And they changed color every day.
Yeah, every day, new color.
But still had the Twitter handle.
But so I guess that's what I mean with being prepared to seize your moment. Like he was prepared with the promo thing with his shirt. But the fact that he went to the open mic with his accordion, even though he wasn't on the billing, he was just ready. And when he got the chance, I mean, I was blown away. And I feel like everyone at the conference was as well. So I don't know what the takeaway is, except I don't know. It's not like you're going to bring your drum set everywhere you go, but.
Well, you know, I think it ties into maybe one of the takeaways that I had, but I showed up to that open mic late because I wanted to take a moment to feed myself since I hadn't eaten since 6 a.m. that day. And I walked in and he was performing, and the room was electric. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is like, you know, I haven't been to many open mics, but I'm like, this is unlike anything I ever would have expected. The room was going crazy. People were dancing. It was so awesome. And it really, I think, set a different tone. I know there was some really great artists that played before I got there. But it was one of those things where, you know, it's easy to go to something like that where there's a lot of people talking in the room and try to play over them. And, you know, depending on the style of music you're playing, if you're singing a ballady type song on an acoustic guitar, that can be a challenge. But man, he brought it, and the crowd gave it back. I mean,
I talked to him afterwards, actually, and he said that Gary, who's another CD Baby team member that was helping out with the sound system, he asked Gary to turn the tracks up, and he said, you know why? Volume is one of the best ways to get the room moving. So once again, he was prepared.
Yeah, and it was great. He brought it, and you know, I'm sure if he's used to playing with a band, it might have been uncomfortable. I looked like he played like this all the time. In fact, I didn't know he had a band until you just said that. So that was something where, you know, in front of peers, I think that's one thing that I really noticed. I think was one of my big takeaways. If you referring to Black Milk, Black Milk's a hip hop artist, and his performance was mind blowing. I'm not a fan in general of hip hop, mainly because I don't like a lot of hip hop that just has a track going and they just rap over. But Black Milk has a live band, and these guys were mind blowing musicians. I mean, it was just one of those things where you're just in awe of the things that they're doing, and it was so tight. And you're going, you know, they made something look so easy that was just so darn hard.
Really intricate arrangements, super syncopated, sometimes super fast. Like,
yeah, and a lot of improv too, live on the spot. And those guys were just insane. And one of those, the big takeaway, how that ties back into what we were talking about with the open mic, is that I think as artists, it's easy for us to go stand in the back room and cross our arms and go, I don't want to see this. It's not me up there playing, or get very competitive. And, you know, that's where sometimes I struggle when I've got a band playing, and it's like, well, what slot are we playing? And are they here to see us? Are they here to see the other band? You know, those guys are bigger than us, so we don't want to have to, you know, be in their shadow. And so a lot of times I think artists struggle with the idea of just going and enjoying another artist's performance, and one, just enjoying it and living in that moment of these guys are amazing. But then two, not seen as a threat, but actually seen as an opportunity for inspiration. Because when I walked away from the Black Milk thing, it was just like so inspiring. Like, that is what you don't see that every day.
No, you don't. I see, mean, that I level haven't of seen musicians. A show that good in probably 2 years, maybe more. Like, I couldn't believe how good those guys were.
Yeah, and it's like being inspired that, hey, you know, I know that we tend to think, oh, there's so many bands out there and we gotta, you know, break through. But it's like, on the other hand, there's lots of great musicians, and no matter how good you are, there's always somebody better. And take a moment and enjoy their talent and be inspired and learn from them. And it was a mind-blowing experience. So I think, you know, with the open mic, there was some artists that really brought it, and it showed like, hey, you know, this is a challenging kind of situation, and I know these are peers, but I'm gonna bring it and do my thing just like I would if there was 1,000 people here, or if there were 5 people here. And there was probably about 300 people in the room for the open mic, and you know, with Black Milk, seeing that, just letting being inspired by amazing performances and talent. So,
yeah. And, you know, it's like, not to take anything away from other performers that played at the open mic, because everyone was really sort of high caliber musicians. It's just Sean's thing really stood out in terms of energy and also genre. You know, he's the only guy in the room with the accordion. So he really had like that unique, fresh approach.
Yeah. No, everyone was great. There was lots of good stuff. I was surprised at the... because I've never, I don't know that I've actually really been to a true open mic like this before. And I had no idea what to expect. And just the quality in general of everyone that performed was way above what I was expecting for an open mic. The performances were great. People were clearly seasoned performers, and it was a lot of fun. What's your next takeaway?
Oh, let's see. I guess I'll go with the one that I wrote about yesterday. And to paraphrase Martin Atkins, don't be a dick. he gave a really expletive filled
R-rated
speech.
R-rated presentation.
Yeah.
Because of the F-bombs. He's from England. That's how they speak there.
That's just thick air there.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the middle of his talk, he quoted Dale Carnegie. And it was basically the idea of, like, if you show interest in other people, you're going to have a way easier time getting them interested in you, as opposed to just going up and you know, making everything all about yourself and what you can gain from other people. You know, I'm forgetting what the exact quote is, but the moral is, ask people questions and show interest in others, and that is going to be a sure way to make connections and friendships, and those real connections are going to come back to reward you way more than the sort of, like, networky pitch type scenario that, you know, honestly just bums the person on the other end of it out. Like, you know, we met hundreds and hundreds of musicians each over the weekend. And I don't mind if someone comes up and wants to share their music and give me a CD, but if that's all they want to do, it's kind of exhausting. And then you're like, oh great, now I have to hold this CD for the next 5 hours or whatever, as opposed to someone who comes up and they are, you know, asking me questions and it's an actual conversation. And then they're like, hey, do you want my music? I'm like, yeah, totally. Now that I know you, I would love to hear your music. So it's kind of all context.
Yeah, and it may have come from that same Dale Carnegie book, but I've heard it said that if you want people to like you, ask them a lot of questions about themselves. So, because people like to talk about themselves, and if you're trying to connect with people, basically it means you're showing an interest in them, and when they feel that stronger connection to you because, like, oh, that person actually cared about who I am. But if all you do is show up and be a salesman, it's really hard to make contacts with people. And you know what was great about this conference? I did not experience that. I don't think once. I think all the people that I talked to, it felt very authentic and just, you know, a lot of, that's what I was saying now. It felt so different than other conferences where I've actually been at a conference before where I was standing there talking to somebody, someone interrupted us and literally went into a pre-memorized sales pitch. And I was like, are you kidding?
Did you start going to sleep right there?
I didn't know what to do with myself. It was just so awkward that it was like, one, they didn't know anything about me. Like, would I even be interested in that, hearing what they're talking about? I mean, maybe I was just with the cleaning crew there to see if the trash cans were full. I don't know. They just kind of were going around the room, breaking up conversations and giving a sales pitch, you know?
Oh, that's sad and awkward.
And yeah, and it was very, that was a different conference. And so, yeah, those relationships are very key. You know, with Martin's presentation, I think a lot of things that he mentioned could be summed up with, one, working hard, building authentic relationships, working hard some more, being about your business, and having great music. But, I mean, so much of what he was talking about, especially, here's one that he mentioned that I've seen over and over again. I've heard in one band that I was in here in Portland at probably 4 or 5 of our gigs. And it's like, oh, well, I don't know if we'll sell any merch tonight, so we shouldn't set it up. And he's like, you know, lots of expletives saying, if you don't set it up, you're not going to sell anything. So, and I hear bands do that all the time. It's like, it looks like there's only going to be 20 people here tonight, so let's not set up the merchandise because it's too much trouble. And, you know, and it's like, well, then you don't want it. Get out of the way for someone else who does want it.
Right.
You know?
So all of those little mental hangups that we have, like shame or, you know, the fear of actually setting up your merch and no one buys it, so then you look like a fool for having set it up. All those, whatever it is, whatever's blocking you, Martin says, whatever the fuck it is, get the fuck over it.
That's exactly what his slide said too.
Because if you don't, those hang-ups are going to become habitual, and you'll continually hold yourself back from the opportunities you have to make money or to make fans or get the gig or whatever. So get over it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's tough. I mean, it is.
Yeah,
it is tough. I mean, with small town poets, we didn't have that problem. Like, we were always going to set up merch somewhere. But I think even we had this like monstrous, like arena rock sized merch booth. And so sometimes when we played a coffee house, we felt kind of stupid. You know, it's like there's this, it almost felt like we were being pretentious.
Right.
When we weren't, that's just, we didn't normally play the coffee house circuit. So we had this giant merch booth and had to kind of accommodate when we played in those kind of situations. And so it felt awkward, like, maybe we shouldn't, you know. And it wasn't because we were like, no one's going to buy anything. It was just like, you know, this kind of looks like we're being pretentious, but it's just like, you just got to get over it. You know, the audience, if they perceive you that way, just because of your merch booth, then they've got a problem. So,
I know we're getting off topic, but I'm thinking now you could even make that part of your show if you're playing a smaller venue. Just point out your merch booth and then make some kind of joke about how giant it is.
And yeah. And the other thing he talked about is like, you know, I've seen so many artists that are like, nah, I don't want to go out by my merch booth. And it's like, people want to hang out. They want to meet you. They want to talk to you. He's like, put you between the merchandise and them. Don't let people leave. And he just had a whole bunch of different strategies about like, that are really about social triggers and how typically when artists want to, you know, when artists feel are going to put themselves in a place that's uncomfortable, they tend to not follow through. I mean, making art can become uncomfortable enough as it is. You're really putting yourself out there. You know, you've worked hard on something and now you've got to let other people hear it. And that takes a lot, you know, especially for artists. But another thing he mentioned is like, get over the idea of selling. You know, you've got to be able to go out there and sell. And I don't mean like beating people over the head, buy my music, buy my music, buy my music. But the idea that, you know, no one's going to randomly walk up to your table when nobody's there and, you know, pilfer through all your merchandise, find something they want, buy it and leave you a 20 and walk away. You're going to have to be there. You're going to have to sell it. And you need to be excited about the fact that they're there and the excited about the fact that you have shirts or CDs or something that you want them to take as a memento of the show.
Yeah. It seemed like he had so many kind of small ideas that add up to just the general thing that you already mentioned, work hard, you know, get over your hangups. But, a lot of it seemed to be about making your pursuits like a lifestyle. So the one I was thinking of is the mom who realized her son was going to, you know, have a career in the music industry. So she ended up buying like 7 extra beds and putting them in the basement with a fridge. And then for like 2 or 3 years before he went off to college, just hosted the bands that he loved that were coming through town. So then like, not only she's an awesome mom who's like having her friend's favorite band stay at, you know, her place, whatever. But then when he goes out into the world and starts touring, he's going to have all those connections who will reciprocate the favor, you know, like, so that was a kind of a long-term, like making a habit of this pursuit that you have.
Yeah. It goes back to, you know, relationships. You're trying to build long-term relationships, both with your fans and with your fellow musician, people in the community, whether they're known and professionals or whether they're people that are in the same place as you, which that sounded bad. That sounded like everyone listening is not known and professional, but whether they're known and like a major label artist or they're someone who's seen success at a certain level or someone that's even, you know, maybe starting out and you're a 10 steps ahead of them, that having relationships at all levels can be very, very beneficial, and long-term relationships, looking at it more as like a community experience. Because, you know, even when we were, when Small Town Poets, when we were on a label, and especially when we were out in the middle of nowhere, like someplace in the Midwest, and every time we'd hit that town, there'd be a family that would be there and take us out to dinner. And you know, there's one family in the Indiana area that even still today, when we were last time we were there a couple years ago, they came out to the show and took us all to dinner, and they always took care of us. And it's like those are relationships that even as you get popular and well known, that that tend to hang on. And so those things can it's about a lifestyle of being in that community.
Yeah, and those sort of relationships that you're talking about with fans, like the same thing applies to your musical community of other bands you work with. Because if you're ahead of another band right now and you treat them, you know, like crap, and you're condescending and you don't really want to hang out with them, even though, you know, they're just the opener or whatever, like in a year, they could be all over MTV or, you know, whatever. Like they could, not that they play music anymore, but
MTV
they could be all over YouTube. Dating myself. But you know, they could be the stars a year or two from now, and you're exactly where you are, or worse. And vice versa. Like, you know, if you're below someone, yeah, don't be overly intimidated, because everything's in flux and you could sort of overtake a lot of bands that you currently think are like way ahead of you. And so treat everyone nicely.
All music careers have an ebb and flow, and sometimes it feels like you're moving up to the top and things are going great. And then sometimes it feels like things are kind of stagnating, and it's, and everyone kind of gets in that place. Even when you're, you know, unless you're like at the upper echelon, I think all artists go through that. It's funny, after, you know, being on some pretty big tours, I found my, you know, I've had the, opportunity later on, after that kind of came to an end, to be backstage at, like, you know, I interviewed Duff for the podcast at Velvet, you know, Velvet Revolver show, and some friends of mine are in some pretty big bands, and going and kind of interacting with people that are at a higher level that I ever reached, realizing that their day-to-day experience is pretty much the same, and they interact with people pretty much the same, and how they kind of feel like what they're doing in their life, it's kind of like, it's Groundhog Day for them as well. And just kind of like the experience is very similar. And so there, I think a lot of artists have more in common, no matter where they are in their career, than you may realize. It's a lot of like, I get up, I sound check, I play, I interact with fans, I'm in another town, I don't know what time it is, I'm trying to find a bathroom. It's all those weird things that happen when you're not at home living a 9-to-5 job. We digress. Few takeaways. We must talk about the Tom Jackson Live Band Makeover. And I know that you didn't see it all because you had to go prepare for your panel.
I saw a lot of it. I think I missed maybe the last 20 minutes.
Okay, then you saw what was needed to see. And man, I know that there are curmudgeons listening to this podcast that will say, nobody needs to help me with my performance. The magic happens. Tom comes out and, you know, he's pretty critical when he comes out about those viewpoints. And, but when you see the band live makeover, it's just mind blowing. It really is mind blowing. And I think the biggest takeaway, and it was a reminder for me and for all the musical pursuits I'm still involved with, that, you know, the basic, he boils it down to, your songs don't sound the same, so why would they all look the same? And the band they brought out to was, you know, kudos to them for being able to stand up in front of a room of 900 people and get critiqued like this and challenged and put on the spot like you wouldn't believe. They did a really good job. They were called the New York Rock. And so they come out, and they're kind of like a rock band. How would you describe their music, Chris?
Kind of alt-rock with like maybe a little bit of the pop-punk, like Warped Tour sound, but like, more like maybe like a late 90s rock band.
Yeah. So what Tom has them do is he has them come out and he has them play a song. He actually had them play two songs because I think he was wanting them to warm up a little bit more, and it was a quick sound check, so they wanted to give the front of house guy a little bit more time to dial it in, the mix. But he has a pre-planned song that he's going to work on them with them, so he has, you know, some ideas going in. He's not hearing the song for the first time. And it was a catchy song, and so they come out, they're rock band, and the lead singer's kind of like, you know, he has them play it down as if they're performing with no feedback, just play, you know, what you would normally do. And they're, you know, I think what they did would be classified by most people's standards as high energy as far as like their performance. And so they get done and everyone cheers, and that you're thinking, okay, what is Tom going to do with that? You know,
yeah, it was Tom like, that was pretty good. They got it dialed in good enough.
And what he does just takes it from them playing down a song the way it was on the record to turning it into a live arrangement and having them communicate the song to the audience. Not just play the song to the audience, they're communicating the song to the audience. And it's just night and day. I cannot encourage people enough that if you are serious about playing live, whether you are a singer-songwriter, because Tom has... strategies apply to all forms of music. It's not just, hey, I'm a rock band that's high energy. He's got stuff for singer-songwriters, piano players. I had somebody who talked to me at the conference saying that they went to Tom's boot camp, and there was a piano player who was 70 years old, and she wasn't even that accomplished. It wasn't like she'd been doing it her whole life. Which was a really cool thing to hear that, you know, this person who's in their 70s, who's playing piano, still really cares about, you know, improving themselves. Hats off to them for that. And they went to this boot camp, and he said, the person that was at that boot camp and saw this said that person was not an accomplished performer, and he transformed their set like you wouldn't believe. And it was unbelievable to see how he worked with a piano player, and just a solo piano player helped them build a set that actually communicated different things to the audience and made it interesting. So it's for everybody.
That's really impressive to hear when someone like a pianist is so rooted to a particular place on stage. Like, it's not like you can start doing laps on the stage.
Or even stand up for that matter.
Right.
Because even some of the stuff that he does you know, with singer-songwriters is just like, hey, have a stool. You know, it's about visually expressing the energy of the songs. And man, I think my biggest takeaway from Tom's, you know, presentation is that if you're not practicing these things, you're not doing them. If you think you're just going to walk up on stage and magic's going to happen, you're mistaken. And he references the idea, and I think this has happened to everybody, and this is why it's such a struggle for artists. One, for whatever reason, there's this big hang up about live performances. It's not like I picked up a guitar and went into a recording studio and no one gave me coaching along the way. Even when I'd learned how to play guitar, once I actually got making a record, I've had to learn a lot and be coached a lot on how to even approach making a record. But a lot, there's this hang up about even being told what to do on stage and in a live performance. But the idea that you have to practice these things, that these things, if you know, the hang up I was saying is that people, they have that one show that does feel magical. Everything just happens for whatever reason. The crowd is into it. Maybe it's you. Maybe it's they all just came from, you know, some party. And
they're all drunk, right?
They're all drunk and anything's great. But for some reason, there's this random show that happens every once in a while that just for some reason feels a little bit more exciting than others, that fools us into believing that we're accomplished performers. But then we go to the doldrums of the other shows where the crowd's not what we'd hoped, or the room was full but everyone was talking, or we got this great opening slot but for some reason everybody wasn't interested in our set. And it's like, that's because you're relying on the crowd to bring the magic as opposed to you bringing the magic and you driving that performance in a way that communicates to them and captivates them, similar to how Black Milk did, the way the arrangements they made and all that kind of stuff. And it's not just people, most people start to think, oh, it's just running around on the stage. And it's not running around on the stage. It's like helping the audience understand what happens, stretching out your live performances of a song, because how you, people perceive music in a concert hall that's got echoey room and all this other stuff is different than when they're listening on headphones to a perfectly produced song.
Yeah, it's a,
and it's a different experience.
It's kind of about focusing attention or directing attention to the things in the song or in the arrangement that need your attention at the moment. So that might be leaving space and leaving some breathing room in the arrangement. Or it might be, you know, the example he was doing was suddenly it's a guitar solo. So why is the guitarist standing exactly where he's been the whole song? Like, move to the front of the stage and let everyone kind of ease back a bit. So suddenly we know exactly where to watch. Which was interesting because the first time they ran down their song, I had a hard time at first just instinctually knowing who was soloing. It took me a second to like really look and I was like, oh, it's that guy. Because he wasn't doing like a single note kind of thing. It was a little bit more of a riff at the time. So I was like, where should I be watching? And then that was the first thing he addressed.
Yeah, that was the same thing as well. Like without even knowing, I was trying to figure out who is playing the solo right now. Because at that point, the lead singer was playing guitar. And so was the guitar player. And Tom ended up having the lead singer take off the guitar and do the song without the guitar. And so and the guitar player really struggled with the idea of Tom, like literally at one point got behind him and was shoving him to the front.
And he was pushing back too.
Yeah. And because he was like, I can't hear. I'm not in front of the monitor. He's like, we don't care if you make mistakes. We're just trying to figure out who's playing the guitar solo. And he was like, no, go here. And I know people have visions of 80s heavy metal where people are running over in front of the speakers. And that's not necessarily it, but it's a matter of giving visual cues, making things look different. And, you know, there was even where it really started to look different. And I think the exclamation point on this is now I can relate it to what I've seen professionals that have worked with performance coaches do compared to what I've been doing at a club. Like once he got the guitar off the lead singer and sort of worked with, you know, some of the arrangement stuff, the lead singer, then he was like, I want you to go over here to this side of the, and sing to those people. And then he talked about, and then we're going to go over here to this side. And so instinctually the lead singer like ran over there and ran away and then ran back and forth. And he's like, no, what you're doing when you keep running back and forth is basically you're saying, hey guys, nice to meet you. How are you doing? Oh wait, never mind. Just running off away. And then when he had him like stay and he's saying like a whole verse to that side and then go to the other side and sing the other verse, it was like, oh my gosh, it doesn't feel like, you know, it's not, he's running all over the stage anymore. It's now he's actually feels like there's energy being put to different parts of the crowd.
It has intention at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. It has intention. You're singing to them. You're not just running around on stage with a chicken with the head cut off. But anyway, it was great to see that again. I worked with Tom way back in the day and he built a 25-minute set for us that I think has still been some of the best live output by Small Town Poets because it was just nonstop arranged to connect with the crowd in a way with so limited time that we couldn't walk off the stage having, you know, paid what we paid to be on that tour without connecting with the audience. And so it really works. So check out Tom's stuff. I think if you put it to use, you will see, I think, some big improvements in the audience's reaction, the merch sales, and the crowd size will probably start to grow. And he does say, you know, he has a lot of artist quotes, people saying after they start doing this. In fact, someone who used to work at Disc Makers,
Chris
Huff, who listens to the podcast, he said that I don't know if he went to the boot camp or he just had his stuff. He might have been the one that told me about the piano player at the boot camp. But anyway, he said he started doing this and the money he makes every night went way up. Because sometimes he'll be playing for tips and it went from, a handful of dollars to like, merch sales went way up and everything went way up just from putting these things to practice. So that was, it's just such a huge takeaway to see when you're seeing that live and people still struggle with that and they don't want to to be told what to do on stage, and they stand there with their eyes closed and sing and expect that, you know, people to just connect with that. And it just doesn't work. Unless you are already famous, it doesn't work.
Yeah. Every time we talk about Tom Jackson, I just think I need to work with him. I'm so like, I can be that guy. Like if things aren't quite going perfectly, like I don't shut down and have a meltdown on stage or anything, but you know, the eyes droop a little bit. You kind of don't make eye contact with the audience. You stop your stage banter that you might normally do.
And you know what is interesting to me is, oh man, I just had, my mind just went blank. I'm really tired. What you had to do with what you were just saying right then.
Shutting down on stage if things aren't perfect?
Yeah, that reminds me. I think why this is so important, and he talks about, you know, bands typically rehearse in a circle and they don't do this, and so magic is supposed to just happen on stage. And I think what you were mentioning, like, is the whole reason why you got to rehearse this stuff. And it can feel somewhat dorky, like performing to an empty room or a rehearsal room. But I find that when you're on tour and playing shows, the actual show, the majority of that, you shouldn't be thinking about, oh, this is what I'm going to do, or this is what I'm going to do over here. And we're probably really rocking. It feels like we're really rocking. But there's so much mental stuff that gets thrown at you, whether the mix sucks, you had very little sound check, or the crowd's not what you expected. So you're kind of dealing with that mentally. So much of being a good performer, I think, is being able to, on the day of the show, deal with that kind of stuff that's flying at you. And if you don't have a good performance already locked in, that you know how the performance goes, just like you know what chords to play, then the performance is immediately going to suffer. And when's the last show you played where everything went 100% perfect? I mean, even when we've had sound systems on the road with us and sound crews, there's still every night various quirks that pop up that you're having to deal with, like mental challenges that you have to overcome in order to bring a good performance. And so I think that's why it's so important that it's like, the performance is locked in. I'm just going to do it just like I know what chords I'm going to play. It doesn't matter if there's 5 people or 100 people, or this mix sucks, or the sound, I can hear myself great in the monitors. So that's why I think, you know, with performing, that's how I tend to look at it. And at this point, Chris, I'm like, I was thinking yesterday that, you know, I still do music. I'm still, you know, playing some shows with Small Town Poets, but anything new that it comes up, I'm like, I think my sort of key decision point will be, if they're interested in doing this stuff live, I'm interested in playing with them. If they're not, then I've got better things
to
do.
Then you don't have the time, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it.
So,
I don't know where you. I've got one other takeaway which I can say.
All right, let's hear it.
So, like, there's plenty of, you know, specific things throughout the conference. People learned, you know, how to sign up for Sound Exchange and why that's important, and you know, making sure your metadata and ISRC codes are correct, and you know, all these very specific things. But another high level thing that I really appreciated was, this one guy early on in the conference came up to the CD Baby booth, and he came up and we said, "Hey, how's it going?" And he said, "Good." And he seemed a little bit, I don't know if shy is the right word, but he kind of just said, "You know, I'm a little intimidated. I've never been to one of these things. I kind of don't know what to do or who to talk to, or like, you know." But it wasn't like, he did it in such a sincere way that we all kind of grouped around and gave him a pep talk and our advice. And I don't know. I thought it was such an awesome moment. Like, it didn't seem desperate. It wasn't awkward or anything. It was just like, oh, that's great. He's just honest. And by opening himself up like that, you know, and just being brave enough to admit his own insecurity or ignorance about music conferences, I think he found out that we were all his allies. And I think the conference had a lot of that going on, which was really moving.
Yeah, especially when, you know, we had about 15 people from CD Baby there, and it's like, it could be intimidating. You know, you see these people walking around working on a conference. It's like thinking, oh, they're too busy for me, or I'm not good enough to go talk to them. It's like, we were there for you. Come talk to us. That's why we did this. We wanted to bring the community together. There's people that, you know, I've been doing this a long time, and Chris, you've been doing this a long time as far as it working in, or playing and pursuing music, and there's still tons of stuff we don't know that we want to learn from other people. And so it's not like any one person has it all figured out. So I think that's great. That was what it felt so different. The vibe was more of community. Let's help each other out. And the cool thing was it sort of ended after the conference was over and we were tearing things down with this really big spontaneous jam session out in one of the, you know, kind of the main foyer room. People just kept adding in, and even, you know, it's like, acoustic guitar guys playing, and then other people come in, percussion guy, and then R&B singer girl starts chiming in and making up stuff over top. It was really cool, and to see that people feeling that, you know, that we're all in it together, and that you know, it's not this, hey, your genre should be over here, this is our genre over here, and you do your thing over there. But it was just like, hey, let's just all be together. So,
amen.
The end. And so, to close things out, we thanks again to everybody who came out to the conference, and especially everybody who listens to the podcast that said hi and came to our special taping. It's always great to meet people. I know we're up here in Portland, and Chris is, you're over there in Maine, which is that still in the United States?
Currently.
Until
we secede.
And so it, we're not like in LA or New York, so it's not as often that we bump into folks. So it was so great to meet you and hang out with you folks. My heart is full. My heart is full. That's all I can say. And we do have plans to do this again next year. It will sell out again and probably much, much quicker. So when we start talking about putting tickets on sale, I encourage you to jump in on it quick, and we can hang out again. And we're, I think at this point we're going to do it in Chicago, hopefully the same spot, and it'll be Chicago 2.0. So
more deep dish pizza.
Oh, man. Funny little anecdote at the end. I learned that that you don't order as much deep dish pizza for people than you do regular pizza. And I accidentally overbought and bought 5 deep dish pizzas for 8 people. And there's some details about how that happened, but some people canceled on us, and then we had a couple people with us that didn't want pizza, and so 8 people had to walk away with 5 large deep dish pizzas, which is enough to probably feed 30 people. So it's a learning experience.
Yeah,
I'm new. I'm not from Chicago. So all right, if you want to leave us a voicemail or any takeaways you had from the conference, you can call us at 360-524-2209, or you can email us at it's podcast@cdbabypodcast.com, or you can leave a comment on the comments for this episode, number 155, and we'd love to get your takeaways and all that. And if you want to send us a photo, that would be great too. We're collecting those, and yeah, so.
And people are leaving some of their thoughts on Twitter with the it's kind of one of those double hashtag situations. Hashtag DIY musician, hashtag takeaway.
Ah, yes. And I have seen those. So do that as well. And yeah, so we've got more episodes of the podcast coming. And stay tuned. So we'll catch you guys later.
Peace. Was the record button on?
Yes, it was. You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.